This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The diagnosis of cancer is frightening, but genetic tests now tell some people they have a predisposition for the disease. The odds are terrifying, and so is the remedy. Filmmaker Joanna Rudnick learned that she inherited a genetic mutation in one of the BRCA genes, which dramatically increases the chances of cancer, and faced an awful decision about prophylactic surgery to have her breasts and ovaries removed before she turns 35. To find out more, she made a TV documentary where she speaks with doctors, genetic counselors, family members, and with women in the same situation. Linda Pedraza was diagnosed with ovarian cancer at the age of 42.
I have no breasts. I have no hair. I have no ovaries. I have no uterus. I have no hormones.
It sucks. It really does.
To say that, oh, it doesn't matter is a lie. It sucks.
But in spite of how awful it is to feel less than female, being alive is what matters.
Right.
And in retrospect, if I could have turned the clock back, I would have had all those surgeries. It may not be the ideal life that you want, but it's life. You don't mess with it.
Linda Pedraza, one of the women featured in Joanna Rudnick's documentary In the Family. The film starts to air tomorrow night on public television as part of the PBS TV series POV. Later in the program, why politics is less like logic and more like football. But first, we want to hear from listeners who know that breast or ovarian cancer runs in their family. Do you want to find out your risk? If you tested positive for BRCA1 or 2, what was the result? What did you do? Tell us your story. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Director and producer Joanna Rudnick joins us now from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. And nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks, Neil. Nice to be on the program.
And you said in the film that when you first found out that you were positive for the mutation, it was even hard to talk to anybody about it. And then you decided to make a documentary.
I know, it's quite a leap. When I first tested positive, I didn't even tell one of my closest friends, who was a colleague and a science journalist, who knew I had taken the test, that I had tested positive. I was in complete denial. I actually told her that I was negative, and I did not want anyone to know. I really felt isolated and stigmatized, and this was part of the underlying reason why I wanted to make the film.
And it is a journey of discovery, and you portray it that way.
It's absolutely a journey of discovery. And the piece that you played earlier from Linda Pedraza, where she says, it's life and you don't mess with that. If I could have had all those surgeries and if I could turn the clock back, I would have. Well, that stays with me every single day, hearing her say those words. You know, in retrospect, she would have had the surgeries. And she's telling that to me and other women in my position who know we have this incredible chance of getting breast and ovarian cancer, and know also that the only true preventative option is this horrible choice of having prophylactic surgery.
And later on, her husband in the film says, you know, she just couldn't pull the trigger. She knew she had to do it, but she kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, and finally it was too late.
Absolutely, and I understand that. I am someone who is struggling with these decisions right now, still, after 5 years of a filmmaking process and talking to women and families across the country. I want to have children, so I'm holding on to my ovaries until I'm 40. My mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer when she was 43. So these are extremely difficult decisions, especially for young women who are unattached and want to have children and aren't necessarily ready to make the surgical decision to remove their breasts and reconstruct them as well. So I think that's another reason why I really wanted to include my own story.
And your mother, we should say, survived her cancer. And though you go through your family tree, and it's heartbreaking, the number of women in your family who have died of breast or ovarian cancer.
It is heartbreaking. And I never realized that I had this extremely compelling family history of breast and ovarian cancer until my family went through this genetic counseling process. We really never talked about my mother's cancer after she was in remission and survived. It was 15 years after her cancer that we actually got genetic testing. And it was then that I learned that my grandmother, my mother's mother, had had breast cancer. She had always pulled her nightgown down away from her shirt at night when I would be cuddling with her to hide her mastectomy. So I actually even never knew that we had so much breast and ovarian cancer in the family. And when I saw that family tree, it felt like I was at the bottom of a funnel.
And there's another heartbreaking scene in this film where your mother talks about feeling that she has given you this terrible situation.
It's true. And I think that's something that many women who have children feel the same way, that they've passed this on, that they've, in a sense, given their child something that's bad, something that's harmful. And of course, you know, we know that it's absolutely chance, and there wasn't anything that that generation could have done to prevent passing on to their children. But it doesn't take away that feeling of guilt.
The feeling of guilt. It's also a situation that puts enormous strain on families. One of the things that happens is you've just met a young man and pretty interested, and you decide at first not to tell him, and then he, in fact, Googles your name and finds out, you know, like the next day that you're making a film about this and we're going to listen to one of his clips from the film where he talks about the difficulties that this puts on his life.
You can't help but catastrophize when you hear something like that. And, you know, it feels awful to think about, well, what does that mean for me? It's so selfish. Instead of, what does that mean for her? And what this all has to do with our relationship. Like, does she only like me because she wants my babies? You know, and she wants them quick?
I still laugh when I hear that line.
looking back on it, it is, though, a situation which, you said, put enormous strains on this relationship.
Absolutely. I think that, I really wanted to be able to tell Jimmy and to tell any partner in my own way about having this mutation. But putting myself in the film, in a sense, I gave up that anonymity. And he was able to Google me and find out that I carried this mutation and had these incredible odds of getting breast and ovarian cancer. And then turning the camera on the relationship added a whole other dimension, of course, and then constantly talking about these issues. But I thought it was important for other young women out there to see what it was like for couples having these conversations about how, you know, to have children and when to have children and how body image and how these potential prophylactic surgery decisions would indeed impact a young relationship. So I'm very grateful to Jimmy also for putting himself out there in the film.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Our number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We're talking with Joanna Rudnick, director and producer of In the Family, a documentary on her BRCA gene mutation and the decision that she and other women in her situation face. Let's go to Karen, and Karen's on the line with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hi. I had prophylactic bilateral mastectomy 7 years ago when I was, I guess it'd make me 35. I had my mother, who had breast cancer twice and died from it. Her sister had it twice and is still alive, and their mother had it twice. And when my aunt came with her second malignancy, I thought, you know, I'm having these bad boys taken off. I just couldn't fathom. I had two small boys. They were 7 and 4 at the time. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't risk it that I wouldn't be there for them.
You know, I think what Karen, that story is, since I've been making the film, a number of women have come up to me and they've said that very thing. And I think it's the bravest decision to say, I'm going to prevent myself from getting cancer and have a prophylactic mastectomy. And I think it's a sexy decision. And I try to show that in the film. I try to show women who've had prophylactic mastectomy and have these beautiful reconstructions and are still sexy and living very full lives and are really grateful that they've been able to save themselves from getting these terrible diseases that they've seen their family members die of.
One of them is a woman named Ariella, who had the prophylactic mastectomy, and talks in the film about how testing BRCA positive affected her relationship with her husband. And she shows off these amazing breasts, but then recounts this conversation.
I could see how this could totally stress a marriage, but he was there for every single step of the way. I mean, there was a moment, like in the beginning, when I said, "Are you still going to love me if I have my breast removed?" And he said, "I don't know." And I went, "Oh, my God." And I just, like, stared at him. And then, you know, it was so awful because he knew he said the wrong thing. And I knew he said the wrong thing. And he couldn't, like, shove the words back into his mouth. They were out there.
Karen, I wonder if that resonates with you in some ways.
It does. My then spouse said, "Why are you panicking? Is it going to be your ovaries next, your uterus next?" And he was involved in all the sexuality of it. And I said, "You know what? I realize that you are not here to support me." And so on August 1st of 2001, I kicked him to the curb. August 7th, I had the surgery. I'm the only person I know that lost three boobs in 1 week.
And I think what Karen's showing also is that there's a lot of humor in this. And that's something also that I really tried to infuse in the film, too, that there's a lot of jokes about keeping your breasts and, you know, and having reconstructions and just, you know, all the sexuality aspects of it. And I've also heard women say this is a great litmus test to see, you know, if a partner is really right for me, can he stick through these very difficult times with me? And it shows that it doesn't only infect the individual, it affects every relationship that you're in.
And I have two more comments. I will be one to attest that reconstruction is not always as sexy as you see it in the magazines and the movies. I am not a reconstruction success story. Mm-hmm. In fact, I just saw the surgeon today and said, you know, if I could take them off, if there was a money-back guarantee, I'd have my money back now. And I just would have no breast implants at all. But they are. It is what it is. When their lifetime is up, I will have them removed and I'll be much more comfortable. They're not perky. I have to wear a bra 24 hours a day. And, you know, what I did gain is taking my chances of breast cancer from greater than 35% to less than 0.2. And if I'm going to gamble in Las Vegas, I know which table I'm going to play at. And my last comment is that when I did decide to have this surgery, I decided to have some fun with it, and I had a boob voyage party. And so, you know, you got to go in with it, loving yourself, and embracing the people that are going to embrace you and support you through this.
Karen, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks for the movie.
And good luck to you. We're talking with Joanna Rudnick about her film In the Family. In a moment, her doctor will join us to talk more about these genetic tests and the difficult decisions about prophylactic surgery. We're also taking your calls about your stories. 800-989-8255. You can also send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When filmmaker Joanna Rudnick learned she had inherited a genetic mutation that made her much more likely to develop cancer, she did what she knew best, made a documentary film about her experience. In the Family tells the story of the impossible decision she faced to consider preemptive surgery before any diagnosis of cancer. The film airs as part of the POV series on PBS starting tomorrow. We want to hear from listeners who know that breast or ovarian cancer runs in their family. Do you want to know if you have the risk? If you tested positive for BRCA1 or 2, what was the result? What did you do? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Janet. Janet with us from Medford in Oregon.
Hi, Neil. I had the prophylactic surgery in 1982 when I was 42. My mother and her mother had both passed with breast cancer, and I knew in my own mind that I wanted to do anything I could to reduce my risk, but at the time it was a very strange thing to do, and it was, you know, my husband understood intellectually, but I think it was hard for him, and people tended to feel sorry for me. Mm. I was quite happy that it was available. The insurance companies didn't exactly understand that I was at less risk after having the surgery. So when I would apply for insurance, you know, I would have to fill out a form about that I, you know, my premium shouldn't reflect that I'd had breast cancer.
Right, and they saw it as, I suppose, as elective surgery.
Yes, and so it was a little bit hard to get them to agree.
Fortunately, I think that that's changed in terms of getting insurance companies to cover prophylactic surgery for women who are BRCA, but there's still a lot of problems. I've heard anecdotal stories of women who are BRCA positive trying to get their ovaries removed, and they say, but this is only breast cancer, the insurance company. So there's still hurdles in getting insurance companies to cover these surgeries.
Janet, looking back, any regrets at all?
None. The fear of the breast cancer, because mm-hmm. my mother was ill when I was still at home, was with me very strongly, and it just, having the surgery, I had done everything I could to reduce my risk, and that just made my inner life much more serene. It was the right decision for me.
And obviously, you're calling what, 26 years later,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, I was 42, and I'm 68 now, and my implants are still fine, and everything is good that way.
That's good to hear.
Janet, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Janet.
Joining us now is Dr. Lee Shulman, Anna Ross Lapham Professor in Obstetrics and Gynecology at Northwestern University. Also, Joanna's doctor. He's with us from his home in Chicago. And Dr. Shulman, nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And just tell us, watching this film, you come away with the feeling, it's obviously about women with this condition, but you come away with the impression that there are lots of women with this condition. How common is it?
Well, there are lots of women who have some sort of predisposition to either breast or ovarian or both cancers. Probably in the general population, we're looking at about somewhere between 3 to 4%, depending on family history and ethnic background. But I think what people need to come away from the film recognizing is not just the number of people, but what, you know, women like Joanna and all the women who've called in today, the incredible courage that it takes to sort of recognize this risk and to even go out and find out what options are available to you to reduce the risk, and even for those who don't want to take those options.
Because it certainly seems like it could be just paralyzing.
It's incredibly paralyzing. I've seen this take highly successful, motivated women and essentially return them to the home unable to function in society or in their families. And I think what the film shows is not just the impact of this information, but also how women and their families have sort of taken this information and gone forward after much angst in their lives and in their families' lives.
Here's an email that goes to this point from Juliana in Brigantine, New Jersey. How does one find out if they are not lucky or willing enough to look but have family members that also should have had the surgery?
Well, you know, that gets into hopefully your doctor, whether it be a gynecologist or an internist, takes a good family history, finds out about ethnic backgrounds. Just because somebody is Jewish doesn't mean they are of Eastern European Jewish ancestry or vice versa, and takes the time, and it's not an awful lot of time, but takes the time and effort to sort of put two and two together to see whether or not there is that risk. Most physicians are not going to have the time or the expertise to do it, but they do have the ability to call a geneticist, and there are genetic counselors and geneticists around the country who can provide that level of expertise and as well as the support for those who wish to get screening or don't wish to get screening.
Here's another email from Stacy in Houston, Texas. I'm curious at what age you think it's appropriate to get this test. I knew at the age of 14 that my family, who is Jewish, which also increases the risk of breast and ovarian cancer, carried one of the mutations that go with the Jewish heritage. My grandmother died of breast and ovarian cancer. My aunt survived breast cancer only because she got tested for the mutation, and they found it shortly thereafter. I am negative, but I'm wondering, I don't think I could have handled that test at 14, which is when my mom began talking about it. When is the right age?
You know, that's a difficult. I can tell you what's not the right age, and 14 is definitely not the right age. But what is the right age probably isn't until at least the 20s, and probably mainly because for somebody who is potentially at risk for having one of the mutations, we're going to be managing that woman in the same way. We're going to be offering that woman oral contraceptives to prevent her from ovulating. We're going to be doing frequent breast exams in the office, mammography, even MRI, are not things we would be offering to teenagers or even to 20-something-year-old women. So what would be the right age? Probably the mid to early 20s. But clearly, just because of the emotional issues involved, and both, and I think you see this from the film, both when you find out you are a carrier, as well as finding out that you're not a carrier, I think there needs to be a level of some maturity in that person who is going to then be able to make a decision on how to proceed with that information.
Joanna, there's an extraordinary scene in the film where three sisters go in, all tested at the same time, get their results to find out they are positive. They do have the genetic mutation, and one finds she does not.
And what you see is that the sister who finds out that she doesn't carry the mutation feels a tremendous amount of guilt for not having it. She feels, you know, she's let her other sisters down. I mean, these are, in a sense, very complicated emotions. And these three sisters were so worried that finding out the information would in some way impact their relationship.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Ken. Ken with us from Flint in Michigan.
How are you? Good night.
Good.
You know, my wife had breast cancer, and she tested positive for the genes, and she went ahead and had the hysterectomy. And now my daughters, who are age 14, and my oldest daughter will be 18 here in November, they are scared to death that they're going to test positive. And they don't know what to do, and my wife and I both don't know what to do. You know, we talk about cancer, and they go into sheer panic.
Dr. Shulman, any advice?
Well, some straight out advice, and clearly I'm unable to say exactly what to do. Not, you know, taking care of your daughters, but if your daughters are healthy, if they are able to use hormonal contraceptives, the very good news. And I know they're scared, and they should be, because this breast and ovarian cancer increased risk is a real thing if they have the gene mutation. But the real good news is that regardless of whether they have the mutation or not, we have a proven way to reduce their risk of ovarian cancer, and that's through the use of oral contraceptives, even if they're not sexually active. I think we tend to think of birth control pills as just controlling birth. But even if they're not sexually active, I would be strongly encouraging your daughters, if they can take it, to use birth control pills. That will markedly reduce their risk of ovarian cancer and not increase their risk of breast cancer. And with regard to their breast cancer risk, let's say you knew that they were both carriers. There really wouldn't be anything that we would be doing for them as far as screening until their 20s. So even though that erstwhile sword of Damocles may be hanging over them, there's a really effective way of reducing their risk of ovarian cancer. I would get them in for some genetic counseling to put things into perspective for them and really encourage them to go on and live their life, understanding that there is testing down the road that they may wish to or not wish to undergo later on.
Okay.
Ken, we wish you and your daughters and your wife the best of luck.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it. Let's see if we can go now to Mindy. Mindy with us from Iowa City in Iowa.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I'm calling because I have a sister that tested positive for the gene, had breast cancer in her 40s. I have an aunt that had ovarian cancer as well as her daughter. I was advised against testing because of how it could affect my insurance down the line, that I could be dropped and perhaps never picked up again.
Joanna, this is something you address in the film.
Absolutely. Hi, Mindy.
Hi.
In the film, we cover the passage of the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which Congress signed into law this year, which is an incredible victory. And that will take effect in 2009 and does offer protection from discrimination by your insurance company and your employer. And most states also have laws that currently protect you from discrimination based on a BRCA test result by your insurance company.
And so, has anybody utilized these laws to get protection from being dropped?
Well, you are protected. So, I mean, the law, in effect, I mean, there has been no known cases of anyone being discriminated against by an insurance company based on a BRCA test result. So I tested anonymously, but if I had to do it again right now, I would actually test and put the information in my file because I want my doctors and my insurance company to know that I'm BRCA positive so that I can get my screening tests covered by my insurance company.
Yeah, the doctor was actually, you know, shielding the possibility of me having this gene from my file, but also advocating for an MRI for examination.
And that may be difficult to cover without acknowledging the fact that you have the BRCA mutation.
Yeah, that's what she said, but she's really going for it, so I appreciate that.
Yeah. The other thing I just wanted to add to that is, you know, Neil, I was 27 when I tested positive for the BRCA mutation, going back to that question of when you test.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's extremely individual. It was still overwhelming information for me at 27, but I was glad that there was at least something I could do. I could take the birth control pill, as Lee had mentioned. I could start screening my breasts. And I think that, you know, it can be extremely difficult information, especially when you get it. And if you test positive at a time when there really isn't screening available for your breasts because they're too dense and you can't do mammogram at that age. So I think that it's really important that genetic counseling is a key component to this process. Talking to a genetic counselor, going over the options, how you might feel if you're positive or negative, and really thinking through before you get the test.
Genetic counseling, a profession I didn't understand existed until I saw this film. Mindy, thanks very much for the call. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Joanna Rudnick about her film In the Family, also with her doctor, Dr. Lee Shulman. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Ann is on the line. Ann calling us from Boise in Idaho.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Go ahead, Ann.
I was tested a week ago for the BRCA genes. They run heavily in my father's family, and my brother and my sister and I all made a trek to the Huntsman Cancer Institute in Salt Lake, and we're waiting for our results right now. I have great optimism that knowledge is power, and knowing that this is a possibility, I can make choices and take steps that seem wise and thought out mean that I eventually become a great grandma.
And you're getting a lot of sleep?
Yeah.
Good.
Not really. It doesn't really wake me up at night. I have watched a lot of my father's family either have breast or ovarian cancer, die from them. And when I was younger, I remember losing sleep over it. And now I'm middle-aged, and I think, well, I could get hit by a car when I leave my driveway today, and every opportunity I take to live well and live thoughtfully, including things like genetic testing when I find out that this is in my family gene pool, seems good.
That's a great story, Ann. But waiting for the results has got to be a little nervous.
Well, sort of, mostly because I'm peering anxiously into my future, which is the fork in the road. Either it's a real short fork, and if I'm negative, and if I'm positive, I will probably have a hysterectomy right away, and think and ponder some more on the idea of the prophylactic surgery. At this point, that feels very radical. I'm encouraged to hear what other women who have experienced this have to say about, like 20 years later of the reconstructive surgery.
And I wanted to ask Joanna before we wind up, have you made the decision to go ahead with the surgeries, or is it just a question of scheduling at this point, or are you still debating?
No, I have made the decisions to have the surgeries. I'm going to have my ovaries removed after I have children by age 40. And I'm going to have the breast surgery. I'm not ready to do it just now. My mother actually recently had the breast surgery and set a wonderful example for me. And she said, this is really my ticket to life. She's 65. She didn't want to worry about getting breast cancer. She survived ovarian cancer. So she's really, I think, her example has pushed me closer to knowing that I can have that surgery.
Have you had children, Ann?
I have. I have 5 sons.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's great.
Thanks very much for the call.
Uh-huh.
Good luck, Ann.
We don't have time. We've got some other interesting questions. But Joanna Rudnick, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Joanna Rudnick's film In the Family begins airing on public television stations tomorrow night as part of the POV series. And Dr. Shulman, thank you so much for your time today, too, for answering our questions.
I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Dr. Lee Shulman, Anna Ross Lapham, professor in obstetrics and gynecology, co-director of the Northwestern Ovarian Cancer Early Detection and Prevention Program, and also Joanna Rudnick's doctor. He joined us on the phone from his home in Chicago. Up next, it's not what the candidates say in this election, it's what the voters hear. There's a difference. Why we only hear what we want to and ignore the rest. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Governor Palin did not ban books from the public library as mayor of Wasilla, and Senator Obama was not sworn into the Senate with his hand on the Koran. Even so, plenty of people believe one or the other, but not both. Why? The reason is simple, and once again, Psych 101 rears its head. Confirmation bias. In a moment, we'll talk with Bill Bishop about why voters hear what they want to hear and ignore what they don't. True or false, have you ever gone out of your way not to hear something that might upset your existing political beliefs? Liberals, did you skip George Bush's State of the Union? Conservatives, did you skip Bill Clinton's? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Bill Bishop is the author of the book The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. He recently wrote a piece for Slate called In Politics, It's Not What They Say, It's What You Hear. And he joins us now from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Nice to have you back on the program.
Good to be here.
Do voters really go out of their way not to hear what upsets existing beliefs?
Well, they really do. I think you cited a really good example, one that Gallup picked up in the 1990s, is that Democrats would flock to hear a Bill Clinton give his State of the Union address, and Republicans would stay away. And then when Bush came into office, it just flipped. But I think this is a long. People have seen this every way they look at it. In Europe, there are a lot of towns with a liberal paper and a conservative paper, and when you look, you see the conservatives get the conservative paper and liberals get the liberal paper, and people like to hear what reinforces their beliefs.
And yet you say this is not about ideology. Politics is not about ideology.
No, it's about joining a team. It's about one political scientist described it as more a choice of music that you might like. Another one described this is how he said you Donald Green, how you choose a political party. You're going down a hall and there are two doors with parties going on behind each door, and you look in and you sort of scope things out. You see how people are dressed, what they're wearing, and if they'd be the kind of people you'd want your kids to hang out with or to marry their kids. And if they're like you, you go in and you join that party, and that's how we team up in politics.
And you draw an analogy to a study done of two fans of two football teams. They were shown a tape of a game and said, how did you see the officiating? And the Princeton fans only saw the fouls committed by the Dartmouth players, and the Dartmouth fans only saw the fouls committed by the Princeton players. And you argue that, in fact, we react to politics very much the same way.
Right, and we view news media, you know, the mainstream media is always the villain, and in the Middle East, there have been studies done where the Palestinians and Israelis watch the same news program and each come to the opposite conclusion about the bias of the reporter involved, and it's just, you know, humans are the way we are.
Yet, going back to your music analogy, there are plenty of people who like Renaissance music and country and Western and the occasional AC/DC, too.
Yes, there are, but we're more an XM radio nation than anything else. We like to specialize, and we like to hear our niche. But really, what we're talking about is finding a place where beliefs and surroundings express ourselves. And since politics is more about lifestyle now than about demographics or ideology. It's hard to change your mind or hear both sides about the way you live your life. And so our attachments to politics and to party are stronger now. And so there are fewer undecideds as we come up upon the election in November.
Yet more and more people are registering as independent.
They do. They like to think of themselves as independents. But from the 1970s on, there's been a decrease both in the number of split-ticket voters, people who vote for one party in one race and another party in another race. And there's also been a decrease in the number of people who are true independents, people who really do switch from one election to another, from one party to another. People who say that they're independents, if you press them, you can always do this at a dinner party because people are proud to say that they're independent. You say, well, you know, when was the last time you voted for a Republican, or when was the last time you voted for a Democrat? If you guess right, they'll kind of blanch and look down and say, well, they can't remember.
Yeah, probably either Theodore or Franklin Roosevelt.
So right.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Denny's on the line. Denny with us from Rockford, Illinois.
Yeah, Neil.
Go ahead, please.
Hey, I admit I'm one of those who kind of tunes out the other side. And as I was telling the gal that took the call, I listen as long as the facts and information is consistent with, fact. I find so often that when it doesn't jibe, it just infuriates me.
Do you wonder sometimes, though, if you're not just in an echo chamber hearing the same ideas bouncing back and forth, and that there might be a couple of other parallel echo chambers somewhere else where different ideas are rattling around?
Yeah, well, different ideas. It kind of goes back to the statement, you can have your own opinions, but you can't have your own facts. And I like to think that I'm one who pays attention and gets to the bottom of things. And, you know, when the talk is obviously not true, then that is really infuriating.
So you still see yourself as a truth seeker?
I think so.
Okay.
You know, independence, as a gentleman was saying also, that kind of strikes me as someone who's not paying attention. That you either have, you lean along one philosophy, ideology, or another, and most of the time you align yourself with either party. And be honest about it, you know?
Yeah. Bill Bishop, do you think Denny's a truth seeker?
Well, I think we all are truth seekers for our own truth, right? There are a lot of facts out there, and we pick and choose among those facts that support our beliefs. And I mean, it's hard to disagree with Denny about that there are a set of facts. But I mean, you look at this at the financial breakdown in the country, and there are a lot of facts out there, How do we know? So what we're affected by we're affected by the people around us. And as communities have grown increasingly homogenous in the way we've chosen to live, both in our neighborhoods and in our churches and in our volunteer groups, then we, you know, just as you said, our beliefs are echoed back on us. And are these the facts that we hear or we think are the most important facts we hear back from others? And our beliefs are reconfirmed.
Hmm. Denny, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
So long. Let's see if we can go next to Alistair. Alistair with us from Bend in Oregon.
Hello.
Hi there.
I was wondering, to what extent do you think the average American voter is aware of this inherent sense of bias which seems to so pervade our political consciousness? Because I know, from my end at least, my political beliefs, I realize, are entirely my own, and entirely ideologically based, and I realize that I am extremely biased, and I find myself rather resentful of people of either my same political perspective or a differing political perspective who say that they're only after the truth and the facts. I think that the political process is an extremely biased one, and I've always thought that, and am I alone in that, in the fact that I'm the only person who realizes how biased I am and don't think that I have any handle on some greater sense of truth?
What do you think, Bill?
Well, sometimes when I look around America, I think Alistair may be the only one who thinks that. I mean, but it's Elizabeth Theus Morrison in Nebraska did a focus group with with people, and they came from Nebraska, and they generally agreed. And what they couldn't understand was why the rest of the country didn't agree with them. And they figured that, you know, it's those 20% out there. It's those people, those weirdos who much – and they said who must live in California who are screwing things up for the rest of us. And I think that's how we feel. We look around, we see agreement, and we can't understand why the rest of the country doesn't come along with our way of thinking.
And as, Bill, you describe in the piece, it seems to be an agreement on an entire set of issues as they break down on partisan political lines, that one group tends to feel lean all the same way on gun control, abortion, and all the other hot-button issues.
Right. And so, in fact, it was I talked to a county commissioner right next to Bend, Oregon, who told me that the anti-abortion people out there no longer ask him about his stand on abortion. They ask him his stand on property rights because they know that most likely his stand on property rights
will tell you determine his stand on abortion.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Alistair, are you that predictable?
I suppose so. I suppose. I've just seen all of my political principles, as well as everyone else's, as being almost like a gut reaction to which very little logical scrutiny is applied. And so that's how I've come to see it, and I've stopped trying to look for logic in politics. If anything, I look upon it as a grand and rather amusing game.
Gut reaction. That's a pretty good that seems to agree right with your argument, Bill.
Right. I think so.
Yeah. Alistair, thanks very much for the call.
Indeed, thank you.
Here's an email from Patrick in Rockford, Illinois. As the executive vice chairman of the Young Democrats of Winnebago County, I am as Democratic as they come. I am also a COSAC. That means he reads the Daily Kos blog. Mm-hmm. So I don't want for liberal cred. I have watched all of Bush's State of the Union addresses. Granted, I was playing the drinking games, but I still tuned in. So that on the other side. We're talking with Bill Bishop, the author of The Big Sort, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to David. David with us from Ellensburg in West Virginia, in Washington, excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I might be the odd man out here, but I have some very deeply held convictions, and they do fall out in a partisan manner, but I listen to the other guys. I listen to Bush's State of the Union. I read the conservative columnists. I want to know what the other guys are thinking. I want my views challenged. I want to see if they hold up against the rational argument. And at the same time, I'm looking for holes in the logic of someone who has opposing views to mine. So I want that out there. I want to bang it around and see if it holds up in the rough and tumble of discussion. And you can't do that if you're only listening to your own cheerleaders.
I think David's right, but David may be part of a minority, Bill.
Well, I mean, actually, what people find is that on the web, you know, things are pretty much niche oriented, and that people do go to websites that disagree with their political point of view, but they go there kind of as spies and to bring back information about what the other side is thinking. And I guess the interesting question for David is: have you ever been convinced by an argument on the other side that you were wrong?
I have, and I have adjusted my views accordingly. It doesn't happen often, but it has happened, and I find that rather gratifying. And I've also had other folks change their views or say, "Gee, that's an aspect that I hadn't really thought of." But it requires a discourse where both people respect the other's opinion, respect the point where they're coming from. That we all have the good of the country or whatever the discussion is at heart, we happen to have different approaches. If you can start from there, you can have a rational discussion. But what percentage, I'm wondering, of the electorate is of the opinion that I know the truth, the facts be damned, don't bother me with it?
Well, I think the first part of what you're saying, David, is the most important, and that is having those discussions with people who disagree. And Americans love to talk about politics, but when Diana Mutz at Penn looked, she found that Americans were the least likely among 12 industrialized countries to have discussions with those who disagree with them. And it was interesting. The people who were most likely to have discussions with people with a different political point of view were those who had not graduated from high school. The people who were least likely to have a discussion with someone who disagreed with them were those people who had attended graduate school.
This goes back to your argument in The Big Sort that, in fact, we have isolated ourselves into archipelagos where we only meet people of similar beliefs.
Right.
How much does our willingness to engage with someone in another point of view due to the fact that we only have two parties? In Europe and other countries, you've got a multiplicity of parties.
Yeah.
So the person you're talking to may be closer to you, but not quite there, you know what I'm saying, as opposed to the divide we have in this country.
Uh-huh. I think that is an argument, and that's an interesting discussion to have.
Thanks very much for the call, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to Christine. Christine is with us from Bay Village in Ohio.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Christine. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I find the guest thesis rather offensive that the American public isn't putting more thought into their party affiliation. In my opinion, there's things that are absolute right and wrong, like discrimination against gays and lesbians, and I don't sign up for a team that has those points of view.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and on the other side, you know, a county away, there are a group of people that feel that exactly the opposite and wouldn't sign up for that party, and there we are.
And why should I listen to that hate mongering? Why should I listen to them spewing and think they're going to sway my opinion? In my opinion, that's an absolute in life, that you don't treat people unfairly, you don't discriminate against people. There were parties that used to think that it was okay to do that against African Americans.
And I was just going to ask Bill about that. I mean, obviously, opinion have changed on that point of view. And as Christine suggests, opinions have also changed quite a bit on the question of gays and lesbians.
Right. And opinions do change. And one of the ways that those opinions change is through this democratic process we have of people who disagree rubbing up against one another and finding some common ground on some issues and disagreement on others and coming
to... Well, how do you find common ground on an issue like that? In what?
Well, I think that you probably don't. But the problem we have in this country now is that we're enemies on everything. That as issues line up left and right, those people who disagree with about gay rights and gay marriage also disagree about the war in Iraq, and they disagree about free trade, and they disagree about, and so there's no place where they find that common agreement. And at the same time, socially, we're separated, so we don't go to our opponent's kids' school play, and we don't mix with neighbors who disagree with us, and so it all just builds up and creates this kind of dysfunction that defines our Congress now and our country.
Thank Christine for her phone call. Bill Bishop, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Bill Bishop, author of The Big Sort. He joined us from member station KUT in Austin. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.